This is the episode number 40 of the Energy Transition Series. Good afternoon and good morning, Irina Slav and David Blackmon.
Hello, welcome. I'm glad to be here today.
Our topic today is COP27 and the energy sector. Please let me share a screen with you all. Yeah, that's interesting, because the point of Antonio Guterres was the political signal to rebuild broken trust. Yep, it's good in this kind of event. And it's the same speech of President Ursula. See here, we are building trust, climate justice, symptom but not cured the patient from its fever. Oh my God. David, please help us to understand a little bit more about these conclusions.
Yeah, you know, I want to point everyone as we start this to a excellent article published this morning by the folks at the Institute for Energy Research. And it chronicles the remarks made by the president of Uganda at the COP27 climate conference, who lambasted Europe and other developed nations, the United States, Canada, for their rank hypocrisy on climate issues and energy issues, talking about the fact that these developed countries of the West are hoarding fossil fuel energy right now, oil and natural gas and coal, at the expense of developing nations in Africa and Asia and other parts of the world, and lecturing at the same time at the COP27 conference, lecturing these developing nations on their need to avoid the use of fossil fuels and instead build a bunch of windmills and solar panels that are not going to solve their energy needs. It is an excellent speech that everyone should read and absorb. And Ms. von der Leyen and Mr. Guterres can talk about all they want to about restoring broken trust by creating yet another wealth redistributionist scheme to be run by the United Nations, which means probably 80% of it will be siphoned off and used for other purposes. But that's really not what is really happening in the real world. What is happening in the real world is that Europe's desperation for energy resources, mainly in Germany, but also in some of the other countries of the Central European continent, is having a result of denying countries like Pakistan and Sri Lanka and Uganda, and you can just go down the list, adequate supplies of natural gas for their own energy needs. At the same time, as I wrote this morning, Europe is burning an ever-rising amount of wood pellets for its energy needs, 18th century technology now. They're going back to medieval times in their pursuit of green energy, because somehow the heavily polluting burning of wood pellets is classified as a renewable green energy technology by the European Union, which is frankly insane, just absolutely insane. So they can talk all they want to about broken trust, but the trust is broken, and it's being broken more and more every day in this current energy crisis. And nothing that happened at COP27 is going to solve that. And I'll turn it over to Irina. That's my rant for this morning.
Yeah, Irina, justice, trust, what does it mean for us?
Well, to begin with, in addition to agreeing with every single word that David has said, they're talking about broken trust, which suggests that there was trust to begin with. But I seriously doubt there was trust to begin with, because they're talking about trust between colonizers and colonized. And I seriously doubt the latter had any trust in the former when it comes to, protecting their national interests, energy interests.
Yeah.
And as David said, Europe is literally hoarding energy, including Russian energy. They're now on a buying spree of Russian diesel ahead of the second embargo in February. They're buying oil, they're buying coal, and wood pellets. This is it's pure arrogance. And then this fund, which just a week ago, a senior European official said it's off the table. The question of a loss and damage fund is not going to be discussed. A week later, another senior EU official makes a proposal for this loss and damage fund, and they end up agreeing on it. To me, this is a form of saving face, because even with the European arrogance, they stopped short of calling for a phased out of fossil fuels. They didn't do that. They were supposed to do that because they set the stage at last year's COP. And they never did that. In fact, they were against it. So they tried to save face, you know, wash their hands by setting up this fund, which nobody knows if you know, if it will actually come to fruition, this plan, because Guterres is talking about to be operationalized in the, what was it, in the coming period? What period?
What does that mean? Whatever that means. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even know what the verb operationalize means. I doubt anyone does. And what's the coming period? Commentators are talking about several years, because all the details need to be tailored out, you know, how the distribution of funds will take place. Obviously, they will aim to encourage wind and solar and possibly hydrogen, I don't know. But there's so much work to be done. So for now, they're trying to pass this as a victory. That's the developing nations, actually. They see it as a victory, and to some extent it is, because at least it was talked about, the damage they are already, the alleged damage they are already claiming to have suffered as a result of climate change, for which the wealthier nations are largely responsible, because they are the biggest emitters. The other new thing is that COP27 pointed the finger at China and India, which is hilarious, because they are still considered developing nations.
Right. They won't be contributing to the fund, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, some are asking, you know, they've raised the question. I can't remember who's president. I'm sorry, one of the small island nations in the Caribbean, I think, but I'm not sure, said that India and China should also be included in this fund because they're also huge emitters. And this is a complete deal breaker. They won't do it, because they will point the finger at Europe and North America as emitters for a much longer time. And I think there will be a lot of finger pointing while, you know, they try to work out how this loss and damage fund is going to work. And it will all end up in the gutter, I suppose. It really does. Oh, and by the way, did you hear about, you know, how Colombia's president said at COP27 that we should stop oil. What? Oh, yeah, he said we should stop producing oil.
Yeah.
Colombia. And just today, the finance minister, I think, said that they're going to, you know, put a lid on this proposal for now. Because, yeah, oil and coal exports, I think, constitute half of Colombia's export revenue. So sure. I think that president spoke a little bit prematurely.
Wow.
But yeah. I don't think this fund is going anywhere. It's a good idea, probably. It definitely sounds like a fair idea. But whether it will materialize, I'm not so sure.
Sure. Please let me show some comments from people. LinkedIn.
Oh, good. More comments. Boy, this is fun.
Isn't David? Hi, David's David. Not a guy.
let me see. This one is not true. Okay, this one is reparations, a joke or not? And Luca, Luca's here too, from Sweden.
From Sweden. Okay, Luca, thank you.
Hey, Luca.
People, let me go to another point that for me is a let me share here, please.
No.
So I cannot understand so many lobbyists and more than 1,000 NGOs. Why so many people? Are they working? Or are they?
Sure. Yeah, yeah, lobbyists are always working to increase their influence and get part of this money. You know, I mean, you got a multi-billion dollar redistributionist scheme being created. Lobbyists for, you know, all energy sources want to get their piece of that pie, assuming it's ever actually going to be redistributed outside of the graft and corruption at the UN itself, which, you know, may or may not ever really happen. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that there are fossil fuel lobbyists at COP27, I imagine, what did you say, 636 of them? I'm sure there were double that number of green lobbyists at COP27, you know. I guess the surprise is that COP27 is letting anyone from the fossil fuel business actually attend the COP
meeting. Exactly. Yeah. There were protests against this,
And the non-governmental institutions, organizations, more than 1,400. What they do exactly in this case?
Well, they host fabulous dinners for the attendees who have flown into Sharm el-Sheikh on their private jets, and they hold private meetings with them and roundtable discussions, some side meetings of the conference, and that aren't widely publicized. And you know, you try to exert influence over the decisions being made at the conference. I'm a former fossil fuel lobbyist myself, although I never, have to admit, never attended a global climate conference while I was doing that. But, you know, that's the kind of activities lobbyists engage in everywhere. And I don't imagine COP27 is any different.
So is it a war? I mean, a lobbyist, oil and gas lobbyists on one side and Jones the other side
certainly looks that way.
I mean, I'm sure, but there's also you know, growing areas of cooperation and interaction between green lobbyists and fossil fuel industries. You know, you have all these oil and gas companies burnishing their ESG stats by investing wind and solar, and ExxonMobil has its multi-billion dollar carbon capture and sequestration operation going. And so there's all these areas now where you can envision these lobbyists co-hosting dinners, fabulous dinners at five-star restaurants there in Sharm el-Sheikh. And, so I imagine it's not all ground warfare between the various lobbyists now.
Irina, there is a picture that I would like to see your opinion about. What exactly it means?
he was, from what I understand, he berated Trudeau for leaking a personal communication between the two to the media. He was like a teacher berating an errant child. It's so humiliating. It would have been to me.
That's what it kind of looks like, too, in that picture.
How inadequate do you need to be to do this? I mean, you're talking at the highest official level, you know, one statement to another, and then you go and tell the papers. I mean, I don't know what the topic of the conversation even was. I doubt it was anything particularly dramatic. But really, you don't do that. And he did it in public. I mean, everybody was really impressed that he did it in public.
Yeah,
impressive, like a child.
And somebody
because
had
he is behaving like a child, a really egotistical child, with all these censorship efforts and centralization efforts. Canada doesn't look very good these days to me. I can't believe this is happening to one of the, you know, most democratic countries in the world. And suddenly Trudeau is being accused by Canadians of dictatorship.
Yeah,
you know, focusing all power in the government. And I can see some basis to these accusations from what I've been reading. And to you know, to really see, has always looked like a really self-controlled individual. You know, he's in control of himself. And to get him so mad that he lashes out in public, then seriously, you must have messed up really badly.
But David, when Trudeau refused to send natural gas to Europe, what do you see about this reaction?
Well, you know, he doesn't. You know, Canada is in a situation where it doesn't really have LNG export facilities built, and so, you know, his statement was that there's no business case for Canada to take up that kind of operation in the future was ludicrous. Of course, there's a business case. There's a huge business case potentially if you want to do it. Yeah. But he, as Arena noted, has used COVID-19 pandemic as an opportunity to implement an increasingly authoritarian regime in Canada, an anti-democratic regime. And it's really frightening what's happening up there. And I, you know, unless Canadians can find the will to elect someone other than him the next time there's election, assuming there is another election, you know, it's going the way of Cuba pretty rapidly. And I guess that's probably all I should say about that. So, but it's sad and frightening.
Yeah.
Prime Minister of Alberta has now been singing a very different tune to that coming from the federal president. And that's great news. Yes, it is. The revolution is starting to bubble up from below. Well, we can only hope. The problem Alberta and British Columbia have, of course, is that there are so many more voters in Quebec and the eastern half of the country, and those voters seem to be every bit as brainwashed as the voters in New York City these days. So it's kind of a bleak outlook from a federal elections standpoint up there. Anyway, I'm not Canadian. It's not really my business, but they are right on our border, and it's pretty frightening what's going on.
Irina, related to energy, renewables, and oil, what were the decisions about these issues in the COP27? Do you know that?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. No, because they are talking about trust, justice, $100 billion, Trudeau. Nothing clear related to renewables and oil and gas. And
of course not, because you've probably noticed, especially in the last few months, European and US politicians are really big on the grand statements, justice, climate justice, or what is it? Yeah, climate hell, the highway to climate hell. Curing the patient of his fever. I mean, they're trying to be poised, probably, because it's much easier to make grand statements than delve into the details and tell us all how all this is going to happen, how this transition they insist on is going to happen. And because they have no idea how the transition could happen in an actually plausible, realistic way, they're resorting to making these grand statements, hoping that people will react emotionally, which people do for the most part, and will not stop and ask themselves, what are we actually doing? Are we transitioning from fossil fuels to something else that is better? Or are we just going to see our electricity bills go higher and inflation go higher? And we get nothing in return, including clean air, by the way, because, you know, with all this mining that needs to be done, pollution is not going anywhere.
Right.
Might even get worse.
And don't you think, too, I think that as time goes on, the leaders in Europe and the United States are coming quickly to the realization that this fantasy narrative that they built, that we're going to be able to do away with oil and gas and coal over the next 10 years and replace it all with windmills and solar arrays, simply is not physically possible. It defies the laws of physics and thermodynamics, first of all, but it also defies the laws of economics and supply and demand, because you can't, you talk about the mining that you would have to do in order to make solar and you know, to build the batteries to back it all up, back renewables up. You're not going to have a 4,000% rise in lithium supply in the next 18 years. You're just not going to. It can't happen. You're not going to have a 500% increase in the supply of copper, which would have to happen by 2030 to make these goals come about. It's akin to saying we're going to increase oil production from 100 million barrels a day where it is today to 4 billion barrels a day in 2040.
Yeah.
You have to think of it, what they're really talking about here.
And that's why they're making this grand statement, because I think it's a sign of desperation. They have pushed themselves into a corner and there's no way out. So they're trying to make a way out by making these grand statements about justice and fairness.
Generic statements.
Yeah, they're trying to make it about something else. To reflect public.
Very abstract. Yes, yes.
And Luca is contributing exactly in this point, paying our attention about the climate to hell.
This is a great comment here. Gutierrez with the climate to hell statement has rekindled the AC/DC fight between Westinghouse and Edison.
Great.
That's really a great analogy.
Excellent.
It really is. Yeah. And, you know, that's another point to be made about this, is that with every one of these subsequent conferences, and there's going to be another conference next month on some other, they call it December 15. So I guess these things don't go in numerical order. I haven't figured that all out yet either. But at every subsequent conference, the level of the fright rhetoric increases. So now we're on a highway to hell. And I can only imagine what Secretary Guterres is going to say at COP 15 next month. I mean, what's he going to say to top the highway to hell?
Yeah.
You know, I just can't even imagine, but I can't wait to write about it, talk about it on this podcast.
Yeah. See, Tubby Nemeth. Yeah.
Okay, it's a biodiversity.
That's legitimate. Loss of biodiversity.
Oh
is
my
a
God!
Problem.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, and we're definitely responsible for that. Well, just set aside a few $100 million for conservation efforts. I mean, this is something we have been doing for decades. We have excellent conservation expertise already. So, you know, let's do something that we know how to do.
And one great way to save biodiversity is to stop burning wood pellets for energy. I mean, aren't the old growth forests home to biodiversity?
And clear forests for solar farms.
David, let me tell you, Brazil reached 4 million barrels a day production. So you are available to export to the United States.
Awesome.
Instead of Saudi Arabia. Yeah,
great. Sure.
Yeah, we need that heavy oil to come up to America to refine some diesel out of it.
Yeah, that's right. We import diesel from you. Right. Diesel and gasoline, yeah.
Maybe that's our subject for next week. We need to talk about all this diesel.
Oh, how the things issues around diesel.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Nemeth, again, let me show, because she is so expert in this emissions on the pillar.
Yeah.
Which is the Paris Agreement. Biodiversity is the second pillar of restructuring the global economy. Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But what's really happening? Okay. So let's recognize what the real goal, end goal of all of this is. And it's becoming increasingly obvious every week. And that is the destruction of economic growth and the reversal of economic growth and the reversal of population growth, okay? That's what the real bottom line goal of this global climate religious movement is dramatic reductions in global population through the reversal of economic growth. And it's becoming increasingly hard for individuals like Secretary Guterres and Ms. von der Leyen to mask those real goals at these conferences. And as these developing nations, the leaders of these developing nations like Uganda become increasingly outspoken about their own national priorities, they're just going to have more and more of saying these quiet parts out loud. And eventually, the populations in these countries that actually still have free elections are going to catch on and revolt against all of this. Okay, that killed us here today. I'm sorry. That's another rant.
No. That's great. So let's go to December next COP 25. Which 15, number you mentioned?
COP 15.
I guess. Oh, that's a biodiversity.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. I don't understand the numbering.
We'll get some
yeah, I cannot attention. Understand too. 27, yeah, 15, and different names, different titles. Digitalization of the third
pillar. It's the third pillar, yeah. Well, that's...
So when are we going to have a COP on digitalization? They're already talking about a global health pass,
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Talking openly
about it. Fascinating declaration. Yeah, love it.
Yeah, that's great. So thank you for this fantastic conversation this Monday. And too many people send us comments and questions.
Yes, thank you so much for all the questions and comments. We really appreciate it. That makes this a lot more fun.
Yeah, that's right.
Send it more.
Send more.
Send more. Stimulate us to thoughts here. Have a nice week. Thank you so much.
Have a great
thank
week.
You. Y'all have a wonderful week.
You too.
See you next Monday. Bye-bye.